Welcome to Tech Talk by LG. My name is Erik Svalberg and I'm product specialist here at LG Electronics Nordic. I'm fascinated by tech and I enjoy learning about how things work. So this is a podcast where we get to do exactly that. It's about all things tech and we break down different topics and technologies so that you can also gain a deeper understanding of your favorite products and all of the gadgetry around you every day. We're actually up for our second episode about the tech used in cinema. And while last episode was a bit of a history lesson, this one is going to focus more on the tech we use today. So sit back, grab a bucket of popcorn, we're going to dig into the tech behind movie magic. So in the previous episode, we covered things like how everything got started, how the camera was invented, how people started exploring what they could do with those cameras, how they discovered things like special effects and superimposed images. But today we're going to dig into some of the more modern developments. And obviously that covers everything from CGI to green screen to high resolution digital cameras. And that last point is actually a bit curious because the film industry doesn't really deal a lot in film anymore. Now you could say that digital high resolution cameras started creeping into Hollywood somewhere in the year 2000. Of course they existed before then, but really the widespread adoption started around 2000. And since then, they've only increased in use, and already in the year 2012, the number of digital cameras began to surpass the number of traditional film cameras. And this is actually a pretty big step in many ways, but just to give a bit of perspective, until the 2000s, the standard in the film industry had always been film, and particularly 35mm film. Now, you could also use 16mm film, and in a sense, comparing the two is like comparing HD to 4K. To use digital terminology. And it's actually a pretty accurate comparison because the film itself is coated in these small microscopic particles, and those particles react to light. If exposed, they will oxidize, and that will affect the transparency of the film itself. And since those particles are being exposed to the light of every object in front of them, in front of the lens, that is, well, then an image of whatever was there is being etched into the film. And in that sense, it's pretty easy to understand that if you have a 32mm film rather than a 16mm film, you have twice the amount of space for more of these small little particles, and therefore, you're getting more detail. Because every one of these particles basically serves the same purpose as a pixel in a digital format or on a TV screen. But on the other hand, these particles are not aligned in the same way as a pixel, and this is what creates the effect known as film grain, which is ironically so associated with the sensation of watching a Hollywood blockbuster that a lot of digital film actually adds this as an effect in post-production. But traditionally, it would also be a big factor in whether you chose to work with 32mm film or 16mm film, because the larger grain and therefore lower resolution also gave a bit of a grittier feeling, and for that reason it was actually used in a lot of movies that wanted sort of a rough feeling. And you might have seen it a lot of times without actually thinking about it. For example, in the movie Leaving Las Vegas, where Nicolas Cage plays an alcoholic screenwriter who just wants to drink himself to death, that was a good choice because it gave it a certain visual texture that really communicated the rough and destructive state of mind that this person was in. You can also see it in movies like Black Swan, where you have a ballet dancer who's suffering a gradual mental breakdown, or for that matter, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or The Evil Dead, or 28 Weeks Later, a zombie movie. But it wasn't only popularized for the dark and gruesome films, but actually also a very common format in independent films and art films, because 16mm film uses half as much material and therefore is cheaper to manufacture, and traditionally film reels are expensive. But at the same time now, with the explosion of digital formats and digital cameras that can actually pull off the same resolution, if not higher, than 35mm film, high-res imagery has kind of been democratized in that sense. By now, most of us carry around a mobile phone that can probably capture 4K images at least. But at the same time, the home video that you make with your iPhone is probably not going to look as good as one of those blockbuster movies, and if you ever stick around to watch the credits, you might figure out why. You see, while digital technology might automate a lot of the things being done in a lot of other industries. When it comes to creative work, it still hasn't really taken over. And what happens then is instead that advancements in technology have offered us new tools, but you're still going to need a lot of creative people to operate those tools. And as a result, a modern film production has a CGI team, whereas Orson Welles didn't. And I'm not going to make the argument that the film industry has gotten better, because obviously a lot of it comes down to storytelling and writing, and there's no technology that's going to make that better. Because in the end, that's down to the individual creator, and there are going to be geniuses and stars in every generation, along with a ton of mediocre creators as well. But the tools available to a modern creator are vastly superior and have only gotten better with time. Of course, if you want to stick around with 35mm film, that's still available to you. But if you then want to add CGI effects, or if you want to add something in post-production, that is now an option. And some things we do today are probably objectively better. Like in the last episode, I talked about double exposed film. And that was one way of getting an image into another image. Like, for instance, if you wanted a flying car, you could film the car in a dark room and then double expose it so you got the sky in the previously unexposed area of the film. But nowadays, you can just use a green screen and digitally replace the background with a much better result. And while cinema history is filled with these geniuses that were able to do something absolutely astounding with very basic and limited technology, you can only imagine what they would have been able to do if they had access to the tools that we have today. So let's talk a bit about those tools. Let's talk about how the technology actually works. And why not start with green screen? Because that's one of the things that I think we're all pretty used to seeing in behind the scenes clips and all of that. Now, why do you use a green screen? Well, you basically don't need a green screen. You can use any color as long as it's easily detectable.
In that sense, green is a fantastic color of choice because it's a color that cameras tend to be sensitive to.
Because what you do is you film against a certain background of a certain color, and in post-production, a computer can very easily identify the part of the image that has that precise color. But at the same time, you do have to think about things like making the green uniformly lit, because you need a single shade of green that can be easily identified by a computer later on in post-production. Otherwise, you're still going to end up doing a lot of manual editing. Another thing you need to think about is that you can't wear anything with that same color because the software will probably remove that from the frame as well, which is actually the reason why we today use green screens as a standard. But originally, it was blue screens, and in some cases, you might even choose to use a magenta screen. Because really what you're looking for is just a color that isn't going to be featured anywhere else in the image. If you're making a remake of The Mask and you choose to go with green screen, and for those of you who haven't seen the original movie, the guy has a green face. If in this case you were to make the poor choice of going with green screen, you'd basically be taking his head off in any scene where you choose to film against green screen. And while we're on this topic of green screens, one movie that actually made that concept really famous was The Matrix. But it wasn't the only thing that they pioneered in, because one of the techniques that they invented for that movie was bullet time. And bullet time is the effect that you might notice in the first Matrix movie when he is dodging bullets and the camera sort of spins around him. In that instant, time kind of stops, or at least really slows down, and you get to see the camera rotating around the main character, creating what kind of became a signature effect of that film series. Especially as it actually filled a narrative purpose as well, because it illustrated how that main character was able to interact with reality in a way that other people couldn't even perceive. And there you had a camera technique that let us see something that you would never be able to experience in real life. And while today we're so used to just dismissing everything as, oh, that's just a CGI scene, or they did that with digital effects, that was actually not done in CGI. What they did instead was they had a rig with multiple regular cameras, so not film cameras, but just ordinary cameras, each taking one still. And each one of these stills made up a frame. So when put together, it wasn't that every frame showed you one step forward in time. Instead, every single frame showed you a few degrees to the side in the same exact moment, giving you a glimpse into the perspective of that character who in any given moment has total awareness of everything happening around him in a full 360 three-dimensional view, because he isn't just seeing with his eyes, he is seeing through the matrix and reading the code. And I'm sure there's some young people in the audience who have no idea what I'm talking about right now. But to you, all I can say is that whenever you see this in a more modern movie, you can thank the creators of The Matrix for developing that effect.
Now, something that has been true throughout the ages is that creative people will find creative ways of using whatever tools and technologies they have around them. Like in 1968, Stanley Kubrick needed to use the very latest technology in order to film a Stargate, except there is no such thing as a Stargate, and Stanley Kubrick wasn't able to go into space because it was still 1968. So what he used instead was another new technology, which was microphotography, and with that he was able to film ink splashes in a pool of water. A lot less dramatic, yes, I know, but at the same time, it was able to create the visual effects that he then used in the Stargate scene for that film. So he was able to capture some imagery that you normally wouldn't have been able to generate back then, because let's keep in mind, this was a time before CGI, before computer animated imagery, and that brings us, of course, to another topic that honestly I'm not even going to go into, because when it comes to animation, that is one field that is constantly in development, and the IT revolution and the development of more and more capable processors, capable computers, is just pushing that entire field and that entire genre forward at an alarming rate. So much so, actually, that in 2002, the movie Simone played with the idea of a movie director placing a fully computer-generated actress as the lead in his new movie. And now, 20 years later, we are actually at a point when we'll often use CGI instead of stuntmen or actual actors for some of the most daring or dangerous scenes. And if you have a look over at the music industry, you'll see things like the Vocaloid software from Yamaha creating an actual alternative to real singers. And sure, I'm not going to say that it's already at the point where it completely replaces the need for artists, but honestly, we're probably not as far away as we think from the reality that Al Pacino faces when he recasts a troublesome Winona Ryder with a compliant and digitally generated Simone. But a slightly less dystopian way of using 3D animation that has actually become very common these days in Hollywood is 3D generated pre-visualizations. And you might have heard of the concept of a storyboard. It's basically like a sketched comic book that somebody will illustrate of the movie before the movie is shot, so that you can get an idea of how everything is going to look. But these days you could, for example, do a 3D generated movie in, for example, Unreal Engine, which a lot of people will associate with computer games instead, and you'll use that to get a pre-visualization of the entire film, and you can pick and choose between different camera angles, you can spin around, you can basically watch the whole film, and you can even get to see multiple versions of it, because you can very easily spin the camera around, change the lighting, and experiment with every different option that you might have in your mind, and then only use the ones that you know are going to look the best. And sure, the quality of the animation is probably going to be on par with some early 90s computer game with really bad cinematics, but it still gives you a more accurate preview of the movie that you're about to shoot than a sketch artist trying to replicate the idea you gave them, and then reality not looking anything like the drawing. And there's another area where 3D modeling actually comes into play, even if you are doing stop motion. And stop motion, for those of you who might be a bit hazy on the term, is when you animate by using actual physical figures, which you move a little bit at a time so that every frame has them in a slightly different position. And to be honest, one of the biggest problems is facial expressions and very intricate positions for fingers or things like that, where a single doll might not actually be able to replicate everything. So you make multiple faces for some of the more exaggerated face expressions. You make multiple hands, because maybe the hand with the clenched fist is going to be better if it's a solid, and then you're still going to need another hand with the fingers separate, and then you're going to need another hand where a couple of the fingers are together and a couple other fingers are flexible so you can make certain gestures. And typically a stop motion production would have an entire team of people making all of these figures, but these days you also have another option, which is 3D printing. You can 3D print maybe 100 different heads, all of them with slight variations, and switch them out, and the 3D model that they are all based off of that one is infinitely flexible and can be reshaped to fit any scene that you might have. And of course, once it's made, you can also make new models, because if one of them breaks, if one of them is stepped on, if one of them is thrown out because you think you don't need it anymore, it's done, you've finished that scene and then you realize you have to reshoot it. Or for that matter, if the director has a last minute change of heart and just wants to do something different in that scene, you can easily print a new one with exactly the look and feel that you need. And 3D printing is making its way into regular live action movies as well, because you use it a lot for props. And I'm sure you can imagine the advantage you have as a film creator if you have a prop that needs to break in one scene and you're able to retake it multiple times and break the same item, identical item, over and over again. Or simply the fact that you don't need to wait for a prop maker to handcraft every single item that you're going to have in every single scene. I'm sure there are going to be moments that you want that to be done as well, because you might need a close-up and it needs to have the right texture and the right materials, but more often than not, you might just realize that the set looks really empty and you need a bunch of sci-fi gadgetry lying around to make it feel alive, so you print it out, because obviously you can't just go down and buy some spare lightsaber parts at your closest Costco or something. Something else that is rather new to the film industry is HDR, or high dynamic range. And it's basically a technique that allows you to capture bigger ranges of color and light, and you do it by capturing both darker and brighter images, and then the color information from all of them, from the darkest to the brightest image, is used to create a single picture with all of that color information in it. And this obviously places demands both on the camera used to capture it, or all of the equipment used when editing and post-producing, but it also raises the demands on the theaters that are going to exhibit the movie, and of course also on the television set that people have at home, because once the theaters are done, that movie will go over to streaming services or home video, and obviously you want to make sure that those viewers are also getting the best image possible. And these days, if you go to an IMAX theater or a Dolby theater, you will typically be able to watch HDR as well as some other really high quality formats. Like for instance, in an IMAX movie, these theaters are really built around the concept of huge screens. And if you're filming a movie for an IMAX theater, you have to use special IMAX cameras that use special IMAX film, and the film is actually 3 times larger than your regular standard Hollywood 35mm film. And for a Dolby theater, on the other hand, you get access to all of the Dolby formats, one of them being Dolby Vision, which is, I think, commonly accepted to be the best HDR format, at least out of those that have received any sort of wider adoption in the industry. You also get to enjoy Dolby Atmos, which is a really fantastic three-dimensional audio system. You see, normally, if you think about what you would see on the back of a Blu-ray disc, it'll say 5.1, 7.1, and it refers to the number of audio channels you have, or the number of audio tracks corresponding to different speakers in a surround system. But if you have Dolby Atmos, there isn't really a separate sound for every speaker. There is a separate track for every object. So there are up to 128 objects, and each one of these objects has its own sound, moving around with the object throughout a three-dimensional imagined space. So as you sit there, all of those speakers that you have around you in the theater, and they can be, you know, in their tens, they could be over 100, they will all be part of this 3D model. And if, for instance, the sound of a car speeds past you, these speakers will actually track the object that is the car through the space that is the theater, and the audio of that car will move seamlessly between one speaker to the next, to the next, to the next, as that three-dimensional sound object that represents the car moves through the theater. And this technology actually works with any number of speakers. So as long as you have enough speakers to create multi-directional sound, a Dolby Atmos soundtrack designed for a theater can also be played in your home. And this goes for instance, HDR as well. If your TV has the range of colors it needs to have, it can still reproduce the Dolby Vision HDR content that you would watch in a Dolby theater. When it comes to IMAX, well, of course, you're not going to be able to get the same screen size as you have in a movie theater. But at the same time, if you have the resolution and you have the quality of picture, you can actually enjoy the standard of audio and picture that you would expect from an IMAX theater. And this actually brings us to our last topic, because Pixar only recently innovated in a way that wasn't actually related to the actual animations they make, but in the way that they work. So, as you know, unless you've been living under a rock, recent years have been shaped by an ongoing pandemic. And you would probably think that movie making isn't really a home office kind of job. At least not when you're talking about a studio of the scale of Pixar, who have almost become synonymous with 3D generated cartoons in recent years. But when the pandemic hit, they needed a way to work remotely, and they were actually able to do this because a lot of these cinematic formats have started leaking into television because of video on demand, and at the same time some screen technologies allowed for the same standard of imagery that they were used to at the studio. And you might think that a 3D modeler can just sit in front of any other computer, and that might be true for some occupations, but not for all of them. Like for instance, what does the colorist do? What do the editors do? Or the person who actually makes the skins for those 3D models if they're not actually watching the same picture? And I might not actually have found out about this story if it wasn't because I work where I do, because they solved it by giving everybody OLED TVs and making sure that they were all calibrated exactly the same way, that they had the same format support, that they had the same color range, and that way everybody working remotely could see the exact same image. And obviously this is something that is a huge step in convenience for the film industry, but I think we can also end on this note because it's also a big step for you if you like cinema. If they were able to take this leap and provide every worker with the same image to the exact standard that you would expect in a studio, and these were consumer products, that means you, as a movie lover, can get that same image as well at home. And it's not just about those formats, it's also about the resolution. 4K is pretty much the same as 35mm film, and color calibrations are widely available to everyone, and the equipment is usually available so that it can be done for you even by the same person you bought the TV from. And sure, you're still gonna enjoy those days at the theater with popcorn and friends, but when you sit down and watch a movie at home in the evening, that experience is going to be so much closer to the original thing than anything you would have experienced in the past. And in case you're wondering about what that means for the future of cinema, well, it actually looks like it just means more quality, because what we see is that a lot of these video on demand services, streaming services, are becoming some of the biggest players in film production of our time. And while they're not going to replace the cinema industry, direct to home video and TV industry in many ways, and they're replacing it with better quality content, with higher formats, better resolution, better picture quality, and a format that allows them to really transmit that quality to a mass of viewers, as well as the budget to attract major directors and actors that will produce better content and better storytelling. So it's a bright time to be alive, I think, if you are a cinema enthusiast. But if you're more into podcasts and would rather just listen, join us for the next episode when we'll dig into another topic about tech. And don't forget to like, subscribe, follow, or whichever platform you're on. Just make sure that you're back for the next episode.